I'm definitely an addict. My name is Pauline. And I'm short. I know that you don't believe me. This is something I've struggled with my whole life. I would have taken half of Brian's height if he would give it to me, but, you know, when I was asked to come out here and speak on this topic, I thought, I thought a whole bunch of different things. Like, obviously, this is something I've struggled with, and the committee recognized that, and they want me to come share my struggle with you. And that's true. That's true. Maybe it's something I'm really an expert at. An expert just means I have experience. I couldn't put my finger on it. I was telling my sponsor, I've been studying my little full heart out, and I just cannot figure it out. But I do have a story, and I'll tell you a little bit about my story. I'm short. I'll start there. Ever since I can remember, I've had body image problems, and I'll tell you why. I come from a brunette family. And although I pay a lot of money to my hairdresser, I really was a blonde. My whole upbringing, I was a curly, frizzy-haired blonde that did not look like my family. My sister and I, who's in the room right now, you can tell we're from the same mother because, our eyes look so alike. But when I was a kid, people would say things like, yeah, she's the milkman's daughter. You know, I'm left-handed, blonde, and curly. So, like, really, from a very young age, I recognized that I was different. And that's a little bit of what I can identify with you. Maybe you can't. Maybe you look at magazines and say, yeah, that's me. Maybe you have perfect skin. I don't. Maybe your hair doesn't frizz when the humidity's high. Mine does. You know. I mean, maybe you just don't struggle with those things. But I do, because it's the first thing that I can relate to is my physical container and how hard it is to accept it. And I have recognized that, we live in a society that puts a big, big value on appearance, again, I was a teenager, I was drinking beer and gaining weight, and I decided to have this attitude that I didn't care. And that was the easiest way for me to cope with what I felt were inadequacies. You know, I didn't have... I want to say this, it might bruise some people's ego or send them, into a different place, but I look so much better now than I did 20 years ago. Oh, my God. You know, ladies are going, oh, yeah, I know what you mean. You know, not only do we have better tools, but we have self-acceptance, probably. But I just always felt like an ugly duckling. I was a tomboy, and I can tell you, I was 9 months clean before I wore my business attire, meaning a dress or skirt, to an NA meeting. Because truthfully, I did not want you to know what the rest of me was like. You know, I didn't want you to know anything. You know, I didn't know how to reveal femininity. Now, maybe that comes as a surprise because I'm just so feminine now. All right, I'm trying to be cute. Ain't working. Okay, let me try another tactic. But no, really, I had this image of myself and a mask that I wore that was about stay away from me. And the truth is, years later, as I find out from writing inventories, being in relationships with other people, you know, accepting feedback from folks who have my best interest at heart, you know, whether it be sponsor or network, whatnot, I find out that those masks had to go in order for me to really know who I am. I used to hear in meetings, my clean date is July 4th, 1982. I used to hear in meetings that mood follows action. Now, what does that mean? It means that we shift our behavior and then our belief system changes. Do the right thing and you will feel better. And that's a real simple concept, you know, like I don't want to go to a meeting tonight. You go anyway, somebody says something that was really touched you personally, you feel better. Or just for going, you feel better. And you know, a lot of my life has been like that. So what did I do? I was scared to show you anything that resembled vulnerability. And one day, I couldn't go home and change clothes before I had to go to a meeting, and I showed up in a dress. And the attention that I got wrecked my nerves, you know, wrecked my nerves. Because, it, you know, it was different, and it was something that I didn't want to accept about myself. I make it a little bit of my business to try to give encouragement and accolades to other people. I haven't always been good at this, believe me. You can ask all of my ex-boyfriends. But with women, it's so much easier because I know I am one. And I came in here not feeling good about myself, not feeling good because of the behavior that I had to lower myself into on the streets, you know? You do what you got to do, right? And I wasn't raised like that, so I know the difference between right and wrong, you know? So I'd come here and I wasn't feeling good about myself, you know? I looked at the floor for the first time. You know, at least 6 months, I thought I was going to be a shoe salesperson. Because I just could not lift my head up and look you in the eye. It took months and months and months to believe that what was inside of me was equal to what I saw in you. And you know what I mean, how we compare our insides to other people's outsides. And I thought that other women that I ran into looked so much more together. But I'd hear them share, and somehow I just couldn't believe it. You know, like they would say they have anxiety attacks, and I'd go, nah, how could that be? That person just, you know, they don't look like they have anxiety attacks, but on the inside, you know, where it really counts, that person was telling their truth. And I just couldn't, you know, it wasn't immediate that I was able to tap into my truth. I mean, I wrote my first fourth step when I was 6 months clean, and I learned some things about myself. And that first inventory was where my sponsor called me over to her house for dinner, didn't tell me what's on the agenda. She just said, come over for dinner. And I showed up. She handed me a book, a pen, piece of, you know, steno pad, and said, oh, page 64 for you, you know, whatever it was. You're going to go write. I'm going to cook. When you're done, you get to eat. They're showing a movie here? This is interesting. I'm not going to take it personally. Oh, no, man, oh, man. But anyway, so I showed up and I wrote this fear, anger, resentment list. And I got started to get in touch with a little bit of who I am. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about who I am in probably more in generic terms. But this is what I've discovered about myself from writing and sharing and being, you know, you can be clean at home and maybe you'll grow. I don't know. But I need to be here in the meetings where someone will say something that I can relate to and it'll enhance my existence and it'll enlighten me somehow. It'll give me some idea, something I hadn't looked at. I smoke PCP, kids. You know, I ain't that bright. And the last 3 years of my addiction, I smoke creams every day I could get a hold of them and every day that I could manage. And what it left me when I got here, I had no vocabulary, couldn't finish a sentence. You know, I've come a long way. And I forget things very quickly and easily. Where was I going with that? Anyway, so I wrote my inventory to my, you know, my sponsor gave me a little bit of guidelines, and that's what I did. And this is in 1982. We didn't have a basic text. You know, we had each other, and we were very immature in Narcotics Anonymous as a fellowship, but we were trying to grow. And there wasn't a whole lot of people that I could, like, listen to and get information from, but I kept showing up. And after I got asked to be quiet in AA once or twice, I really recognized resentment and anger. And they said, well, the only thing you need to start a meeting is resentment in a coffee pot. So I got in on that and helped start a meeting or two. And I wasn't bright enough to know how to do it, but I could participate in the process. And slowly, I got very, not slowly, actually right overnight just about, when I got insulted, you know, When you hear me talk, I hardly ever talk about what I used. And I'll tell you why. Because I was 20 and a half years old when I got here. I had not shot any drugs, and I had no intentions of it. However, people would often talk about using in graphic detail. And I was really easily influenced and scared and not really knowing whether I wanted to stay here. I just knew something happened here because someone brought me to a meeting, and I felt what you feel, that meeting magic, and it permeated my body, and I had that experience, but I didn't stay in meetings, so I didn't stay clean. And when I came back to my second meeting 6 months later, and for the next few months kept hearing people talk about shooting dope, I thought I didn't belong here. And that's a part of my self-acceptance story. I have a dis-ease called addiction. It doesn't even matter what or how much I use. It matters that I, at some level, I recognize the need for recovery. Left to my own devices, I couldn't do it. I willfully wanted to stop using many times. And I willfully went out and got more. You know? And so I really usually don't even talk about what I use because I think it alienates us instead of drawing us together. Now, I just want you to know that if you think you might have a problem, please let us help you. It doesn't matter quantity or if it's liquid or solid or whatnot, you know? I mean, we could talk a little bit about that after the meeting, but I think I'm hoping that if there's anybody else in the room like me who thought that smoking pot every day does not make me an addict, or smoking pot once a week doesn't make me an addict, that you know that, yeah, I did that. I didn't have to lose everything. I didn't have to use everything in order to qualify to be here. And for those of you who did, God bless you. Thank you for coming. You know, thank you for getting here and letting me know that I don't have to go the rest of the journey. Because, you know, and we say around here, yet, you know, I didn't, right? I got good veins. And I hadn't shot drugs yet.
Not yet.
And yet stands for you're eligible too. You're eligible too. So, you know, I just like to keep it a little bit generic so that everybody just sort of can belong, you know, not to qualify out. Because I really, 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 I mean, I relapsed from March till July. I'd stay clean for a week because I didn't believe I had disease, right? You know, I didn't really understand all that. And I didn't understand about unmanageability, and I didn't understand about powerlessness. All I knew is I came to meetings, I felt something. You guys seem to be doing all right. And even after my first meeting, we got back in the car. It was a Tuesday night, nothing better to do besides, you know, score some dope and drink some brewskis and go to a meeting. And after the meeting, I mean, I had a real spiritual experience in that meeting. I saw my life flash before my eyes. I saw the progression of your disease, you know, what I heard shared in the meeting. I saw that I was 19 years old, almost 20, and that was the road that I was going to be traveling. You know, so I had quite an awakening, and I went home and shut myself in for a couple of days. I only went to work and went back home, and then I forgot what my experience was and went out and used and, you know, came back 6 months later. But anyway, you know, I had a hard time believing that I was an addict at first. And I sat in the meetings and I listened and I could start to relate. I have a friend at work, and he said to me the other day, he said, "You are so lucky to be an addict." And he's right. He really is right. I didn't always believe that. And again, that was something in the process of accepting who I am, okay? I'm short, you know, curly blonde hair from a brunette family. I'm left-handed. They're all right-handed, whatever. You know, in the process of me coming to accept slowly but surely these things about me, I could accept my disease. and I began to be grateful for having it. Not only, mostly because it brought me here. It brought me here where I was introduced to like-minded people who suffered like I did and who were trying to get themselves together. And, there's nothing like sitting in a meeting. And even though, I might not be able to relate to Judy's method of using, when she talks about her feelings, I can relate. I understood from hearing in meetings feelings, low self-esteem, feeling different like I talked about. I did. I always felt different. Even my grandmother introduced me recently to somebody. I can't even remember. She said, "This is my granddaughter. She looks like her father's side." And I know she didn't mean anything by it, but it was kind of funny. Okay, Grandma, thanks, So I still, sometimes I come across that and I go, that was very sideways. I know it wasn't meant to be an insult. It's like, where do I fit in all this? And I don't care. I'm matured a lot. But anyway, a couple of things that I've been able to identify through inventories and sponsorship and a few other things. I didn't like my upbringing. I heard Stephanie say in the meeting last night, and it was so adorable. She says, "And once I realized that my parents were not the ones I invented, but who they really were, and I've been through a lot of that in my personal process, coming to accept who raised me, how it was done, and that now that I'm an adult in recovery, you guys are giving me tools to work some of that stuff out and to come to terms with who I really am." And my sponsor said to me just a couple weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago, but it was recently, said that your parents were gifted to you for the reason of working out some of your stuff. They couldn't have done anything different. They couldn't have done any better. And we say around here, they did the best they could, but it wasn't good enough. Not for me. And part of that ties into, I made a decision many years ago that I was not fit to be a mother. And hear me say that. I made a decision many years ago that I wasn't fit to be a mother. Partly because I was afraid of the tools that I were given, that I would treat my children the way I was treated. And partly it goes so, so, so deep that I don't have what it takes to be a mom. And I've always used this other excuse that, I'm just way too self-centered, self-seeking. It's all about me, and I don't want to share any of that with anybody else. But, it appears to go back to my self-esteem, and one of the things that we've uncovered recently is that I believe, and at such a cellular level that it's so deep that I don't even comprehend it, that I don't deserve. I don't deserve a lot of things. This is my belief at a very, very, very deep level. And it manifests itself in many ways. and maybe you're like this, maybe you're not, but money really plays a big part in my recognizing what I deserve and what I don't. I'll go to Gallo's and buy an imported, not well-made, $10 shirt that I will have to replace after four washings, rather than go to Macy's and buy a $30 shirt that'll last me for 6 years. What is that? It's because I believe in lack, deprivation, and that I don't deserve quality things in my life. I've had to work really, really hard on that, really hard. And I'll tell you that what happened to me, I started to be able to share my beliefs about myself and, guess what, my behavior. We don't talk about money around here very often because it's very taboo. And I ain't going to tell you what I earn because it's none of your business, really. No, I'm just kidding. It's an ego setup, but I don't want to get into that. But I haven't heard a lot of people talk about how they spend. And when I lived in Baltimore, that's where I got clean, and I lived there for well, until 6 years ago. And I was introduced to a lot of concepts that had to do with how I behave is a direct result of what I believe. And remember I said earlier, mood follows action? You know, and sometimes I have to go, honestly, I have to go to Macy's or Hex or wherever, and I have to buy myself that quality item. And I'm not talking about frivolous spending because I'm competing with the Joneses, okay? I'm not that kind of person. But to help myself recognize that I deserve something nice, you know. I drove my mom, while I was separated and not quite divorced, I wanted to do something for vacation, and I didn't have a lot of money because it was tied up in the marriage, divorce, house thing. And I invited my mother to drive. I took her to Niagara Falls with me because I wanted to go, you know. And I thought, well, this is kind of a, you know, an inexpensive trip, and I can do it, and it'll be good. Something a little bit exotic. I've never been there, and I know a lot of people who had. So we're driving. We're going up there, and we stop at one town, Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, I think it's called, and to look for a hotel. And I know where I get it from, honestly. And my mother wants to spend $35 on a lumpy bed motel. And I say, you know, okay, we'll stay at this hotel because the rates are lower. I slept terrible. Mattress was lumpy. You know what I mean? You get what you pay for, really. So I didn't sleep good. And my mom can't help drive because she doesn't drive. So we get to Niagara. Now, if you've ever been to Niagara Falls, it's really, the hotels are very inexpensive and very lovely. I was surprised. So I go hop around to a couple hotels and get some prices, and we, you know, finally, so we get to this one, and I go in and find out that the room was, you know, $62.50. I get back in the car, and she says, "Well, that's almost twice as much as what we paid yesterday." I'm like, $62.50 for a luxurious, newly renovated colonial room. We're taking it. It was lovely. But, you know, I mean, it's how we think about money. And I had to tell her, you know, this is what I want. I know that you're splitting a tab with me or whatever, because that's what she wanted to do. But this is how we're going to do it this time. And we both slept really well. It was great. And then, you know, and then it's like, okay, let's tour the town, right? So I get one of these AAA magazines, and it has 12 pages of Niagara Falls stuff in it. Has anybody here ever been? All right, you guys need to get out a little bit more. Really? Come on now. Anyway, 8.5-hour drive through the Finger Lakes. It's beautiful. You'll love it. And then you'll come back and tell me about it. Anyway, so they have these package tours, right? They're like $37.50, and in the back of the magazine was a $5 coupon. Well, you know, Mom was like, well, do we have to do that? Because money is a big thing. It is the way that we behave with money, the way that I behave with money is a direct result of what I believe about myself. Really? So I say to Mom, okay, I'm going to take a hot bath. I just, you know, because I did all the driving. You look at these 12 pages of literature and decide what you want to do, and we'll pick and choose a couple. And, well, you know, she didn't want to do the work. So I come back, she goes, I guess we'll go on that tour, even though she didn't want to spend the money. And it was fabulous. It was just lovely. 4 hours, you know, whatever. And a lot of information. It was great. I didn't have to drive. And then you find out anyway that every park you go to in that town, you have to pay tolls. So it would have added up to, you know, $30 anyhow. But it was fun. And anyway, I get these opportunities to look at where I come from, where I get the information from, and what really I'm about. You know, I get a lot of my belief about myself from what I was told in my upbringing. And my job here, through the help of the steps and you guys, is to keep what's mine and change what's not. You know, I can stay, and here's a thing Amy and I were talking about the other night. It's real convenient to say I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. Go ahead and be there. you know? Go right ahead. I don't want to cop out like that. That kind of lip service and cliche oftentimes is an excuse to misbehave and stay stuck in some nonsense that you're paying dues for anyway. You know, so I can say I'm exactly who I am right now. God isn't finished with me yet. But I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. That's very cute. Very cute. I found out that I was about to, I don't know, I got fired from my first couple jobs in recovery. And and folks like Peter in the back who were around and probably got to hear me talk about this, it was a devastating and fearful experience for me. But I had just started working on a relationship with the God of my understanding. And here I want to say something else that I have learned to accept about Pauline. Pauline does not tiptoe through the clouds with God. I hear people talk about their relationship, and I have respect and even envy for them. I'm jealous about that. But you know what? That does not make me less of a person. It just is my reality. I'm a real practical girl, and sometimes practical is spiritual. And if you hang around with me for a while, you'll see what I mean. You know, I don't overextend myself. I don't live grandly. You know, I have the same car I've had for 7 years, and it's paid for. And, you know, I'm not extravagant per se, but then again, I am, because Pauline likes to travel. Pauline went to Bangkok last year. Pauline's wearing a lovely pink sapphire ring, 22 karat gold, because I could get that for myself from Bangkok. I had clothes made. You know, it was beautiful, and this was my experience because I'm not okay to stay in Baltimore my whole life and call each other hun. You know, and if you want to do that, that's cool, you know. But what I'm saying is, you've given me an opportunity to delve deep into who I am or who I want to be. And who I want to be is not in a small box. And folks, and Gary said to me walking up the aisle, you know, something about my size. And I say, I'm small. I'm not small. I'm a big, big person. I have lots of personality. And that is one of the gifts that you gave me, because when I came in here, remember I said, I thought I was going to be selling shoes. I knew everything about everybody's shoes. Looking at shoes, you know. And what I've come to find out is I've always had a God that loved me. I've always been loved. It wasn't always expressed to me in a way that I could understand it or recognize it. And so I came to Narcotics Anonymous, and you guys spoke to me in a language that I can understand. And you told me and showed me, more importantly, that I am not my behavior. And that just because I feel something doesn't mean I have to stay there. I heard somebody on a tape say, you know, I think we all kind of believe that people who are shrinks and therapists tend to go into that field to work on their own stuff. I don't know. Maybe I'm the only one that believes that. But, I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that, you know, all therapists are crazy and shrinks are crazy. They're the worst, the craziest. And I heard this priest say, you know, he went into the convent because he had a real problem with God. And I thought, well, they asked me to speak about self-acceptance. I must have the challenge here. And you know, to some extent I do. But I've been able to come to terms with a lot of stuff over the years. And really what I want to share with you is it takes time. It takes time. It takes tears. It takes beating my head against the wall because I want to change me. And I can't. There's no human power able to do that. There are some human tools that I can employ that help me get there. But first I have to understand and accept from my very, very first inventory that I am angry. Pauline, can you accept that about yourself? And I wanted to be in denial about it. You know, I wanted to say, I'm not an angry person. Look at the body language. I'm not angry. Or, you know, I don't have resentments. You know, I still resent the Catholic Church, okay? I still do. I'm 19 and a half years clean, but I still do. There's, you know, some things about it that didn't sit right with me. And I have fear. And if I don't accept those things that are very human about myself, I can't get help. If you're in denial about something, you just can't hardly be helped about it. And, you know, my God has a good sense of humor and knows that I only pay attention when I get the visual experience. I'm not good with verbal stuff, okay? That's another thing I'm okay with about me. You can talk to me all day, and I just really don't even hear it. I have to see, I have to see the snapshot. I have to be able to visualize what you're saying. And I was going somewhere with that. Smoked a lot of greens. Started with gasoline when I was about 9. Huffed some glue. You know, I got a lot of brain cells. Not quite, they don't fire all at once, you know. But anyway, I found out that I'm a visual person. And gosh, I hate when that happens. You know, it's always at the most inopportune time. I always had something very profound to share with you. Thanks. I've done some stuff here to help me with my ability to accept. And, you know, no one knows me in that capacity better than the present situation and the people that are around me. And I want to, just for fun, you might not like this, but I will. Everybody who came to the meeting today because they knew that I was going to be at the podium and they would have went some other meeting, could you please raise your hand? So there's a couple people here that would have gone, Brian too, right? They might have gone to a different meeting, but came to support me and show me visually that they love me, that they support and encourage. And, you know, even if I ramble for 20 minutes and get nothing said, that, you know, somehow or another, and these are the folks that are in my life. They're the ones that put up with my resistance. And what I've come to learn over and over again, you know, things don't stick to me. I'm like Teflon, you know. I get the lesson for a little while, and then I have to come back and repeat it a couple years later. And Alan says, recovery for him runs in a 4-year cycle where, you know, we're working steps, everything's good. I'm, you know, walking hand in hand through the garden with God. And that feels so good, I'm going to coast for a while. The next thing you know, I'm on the bottom, and I'm hurting, and I feel like shit, and I'm like scurrying and... You know, and that's the way my program works. It's the way my life runs. And so recently, in order for me to get more information about myself and come to another level of self-acceptance, you know, a year ago, I guess it was, I was sharing in my home group that I don't consider myself a very compassionate person, and I think that this is something that I could stand to work on. You know, like I really need to develop that because I'm not tender and kind and gentle. And I really like other people that are tender and kind and gentle. That doesn't take away from my ability to be direct, but... And anyway, you know, so before the convention last year, my mother was, you know, we discovered that she has brain tumor. And, I mean, this whole past year has been an exercise in me not only accepting myself, but other people. And I always have to accept you, but I don't live with you. You know, you are what gives me the tools to look at myself. And, we're going to have a dance, aren't we? And what I've gotten an opportunity to do is work out a couple more things to get me to that place where I have more acceptance of myself. And I found through this exercise, through God giving me an opportunity, that I am capable at some level of being gentle and compassionate and kind. It is not my everyday nature. And I think if nothing else I wanted to come up here and say is, it's okay to be me. It is okay to be me. It's okay for me to be direct because not everybody is. You know, I had to go against the hospital people a couple weeks ago. And, you know, if I was the meek, whatever. If I didn't have the personality I have, I might not have been so effective and businesslike. You know, and I was able to accomplish some things because I am who I am. It's okay that I don't, walk in the clouds with God. Okay? It's okay because people who know me closely know that my spirituality expresses itself in different ways. I'm just different, and that's the part that I've come to accept. I'm not like everybody else. You're not like me, but then we're more alike than different. And you've helped me see myself by sitting in meetings and sharing who you are with me. I'm able to say, yeah, you know, I can relate to that, and talk to you after the meeting and get some more insight into my own soul. It's a hell of a journey, and it doesn't happen overnight. It's a process. And if you ask me in 3 weeks, you know, how you doing, I might be struggling with something else. And that's all okay. It's just part of the process. So I haven't arrived. I don't expect to. But I do expect to be supported in Narcotics Anonymous for whatever I'm going through. And I hope that even when I'm an idiot, you know, and I do things that I misbehave and don't act right, that you'll be able to say to yourself the same things that I say about you in a quiet way is, they must be hurting really bad. I wonder if there's something I can do. You know, so being gentle with myself is a lot of exercise of looking at how I feel, not necessarily my behavior, but knowing that I have to change my behavior sometimes to get to the place where I feel different about myself. Not using, praying, developing a relationship with a God that I understand. You know, helping others when I really want to help myself. Believe me, I do not want to go to a nursing home and visit my mom sometimes. I really don't, but I do it because it's character building. It's character building. You know, and I want to be somebody who doesn't have a lot of regrets because my self-centeredness ran my life, even with a bunch of years clean. So, I have the tools now, and I know that I am loved. I know that there's a loving God that really embraces me. And when I forget that, you're here to remind me. You know, and that's really what my journey is about. I'm not, I feel certain ways, yes. I can change the way I believe. I can change the way I behave. And that's how I get comfortable with myself. So, thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Judy.
I'm Judy. I'm still an addict and alcoholic. I'd like to thank Pauline for sharing, because if you turn to the right of you and you turn to the left of you, you'll find out that we all come from different walks of life. This disease has no race, creed, color, nationality, sect, none of that. And without further ado, I give you Brian.
Hi, everybody. My name's Brian. I'm an addict.
Hi, Brian. Okay. Height different.
And I'm tall. And it's funny, when you're tall like that, people always come up to you and say, God, you're tall. How tall are you? You play basketball? And I was wondering, you don't go up to somebody who's heavy and say, God, you're fat. How much you weigh? And when you have low self-esteem, like I've had for so long, it's real hard to hide when you're tall. You know, in a bar room or places like that, it's real hard to hide. And I tell you, I came here today and I told my twin brother, Nash G, that when I share, I'm not going to leave nothing down in Ocean City today. I'm going to do my best to expose everything that I can about myself, and y'all can take it wherever y'all like to take it. What I'm trying to say is, anybody's got a problem with a kind of like a fifth step in the rooms and stuff like that, this might not be your workshop. I decided that I'm going to come down here and really expose myself and get real. And most of my story and most of my life is not about self-acceptance, it's about self-rejection. You see, I grew up not liking myself, and therefore I needed other people to validate who I was. And before I get started on all that, I kind of want to tell you all a little bit about what's going on in my life. I'm going to get a little off, but there's a lot of things going on in my life right now, and I want to tell you, no matter how far I've come in my recovery, this disease is still there, and it still wants my life. And I'm not no expert on the steps or the traditions and things like that. I'm still an addict that's just trying to stay clean a day at a time. And one of the things that I have to deal with on a daily basis is I have another illness. It's called Crohn's disease. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of what that is, but it's an inflammatory disease of the intestines that's chronic, and it's very painful. And I go to work, and I suffer a lot of days, and I have to take a medication called prednisone, which is a steroid, and that has a lot of real bad side effects too. As a result of taking prednisone for 20-some years, I have osteoporosis. And that's something that your bones can break up, and if you fall, you can fracture your hip. My teeth are falling out. I got like maybe 8 teeth left in my body because of doing that. So I went to see a specialist the other day who a lot of people have been recommending for me to go see and said he's real good with all this. The object being for me to get off the prednisone that I'm taking and to try to get onto something and not have the Crohn's disease come back. And we got to talking about what was going on with me and this and that. And he says to me, well, before we really do anything, what we need to do is a colonoscopy. Anybody know what a colonoscopy is? That's where they take this tube about yay long and run it up your rear end. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, no, not me. Ain't nobody going on my ass looking around. So. And he saw the concern on my face. And he says, don't worry about it. We'll give you something to put you out of it. And I said, really? That sounds like a fair trade, you know. You give me... It sounded really good just for a minute, you know, just that there's that excuse, man. There's that excuse. There's that one reason that you can catch a free one. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to say is that no matter how long I come around this program, no matter how long I work on myself, I develop a relationship with the God of my understanding, this disease is still incurable. Y'all told me that I don't have to live with the disease of addiction. I can find freedom from it, but it still wants my life. And it don't care how it takes my life. It doesn't care what opportunity it uses. And so, therefore, I'm really looking forward to getting with my sponsor, who I don't get to see very much. And he's down here at the beach today. And I'm looking forward to getting with him this evening and going over. Because y'all told me, don't make no decisions on your own around here. You know. And that's something that's going on. And another thing that I want to share is that I'm one of those addicts that's a little bit of the opposite of Pauline. I came in here very low-bottom addict. And I'm one of the ones that had a real easy time with this program, is what I'm trying to say, because there weren't many more options left when I got to these rooms. You know, I can't relate when you people come into meetings and talk about how you went to work and you use, or how you, you know, I'm not trying to say we're different. I'm not trying to separate us, but I'm sharing my stuff. I don't relate how you talk about how you went to college and you used. How you got married and had children. And you, for me, using was 24-hour day job, 7 days a week. Every day was the same. You didn't get Christmas off. You didn't get New Year's Day off. That's what you did. It was just the same cycle. And I used and I used and I used, so I came in here more dead than alive, you know. And you people accepted me before I even knew who the hell I was. And as a result of coming to this program, practice some steps, getting to know myself. About a month ago, I was promoted to a position at my job as assistant manager of an auto parts store that does $2.5 million a year. What I'm trying to say is I'm entering a new realm of recovery. And I'm talking, didn't even know how to brush my teeth, was scared to death that even somebody might call my name at the beginning of the meeting, and I might have to say something. Today, I'm managing other people and going to be a supervisor. And that's a blessing of this program, and I'm really looking forward. And one of the guys that I work for, who's my immediate supervisor, is also in recovery. And I want y'all to do me a favor. There's several hundred people in the room, and he said he wanted to hear the tape of this thing. And this is a wee program, so when I count to three, would everybody please say hi, Arnold, so he can hear his name on the tape? Ready? One, two, three. Hi, Arnold. There you go. Say, I don't run nothing around here. So there you go, Arnold. You get to hear yourself on the tape. And he's working today running the store. Usually the weekend's his day off, and he's working today so I could be down here at Ocean City and celebrate recovery with you guys. You know, that's how this thing works, man. And I'm so blessed that I got another man in recovery every day that when we go through our day-to-day stuff and our minute-to-minute stuff, that I can sit there and he can pull me up when I'm not practicing principles, and I can pull him up. But anyway, life is so good, and it's been a real neat weekend. I hope everybody's having a good time. Like I said, when I grew up on a farm in southern Maryland. That's where I'm from, the Tri-County area. I'm a farm boy. And when I went to school, all the other kids in school played sports, and they went to the yacht club and rode their speedboats, and they did that. And what I did was I went to school and I worked. When I got home from school, I cut tobacco and I raised hay and fed the cows and built fences. And therefore, I didn't relate to my peers in school. And I wanted their acceptance, and I wanted to fit in so much as a child. And then I come, and I don't want to blame all my problems on dear old mom and dad, but I come from, like a lot of us, what we call a dysfunctional environment. And my dad and my mom did the best that they could, and I know today that they love me the best way that they could, but it was dysfunctional, and there's no other way to say it. My dad was a Prince George's County police officer. Anybody from down in southern Maryland that remembers the Prince George's County police back in the 1960s and 1970s, they were some very badass kind of people, man. You went to Prince George's County and you broke the law and you gave a policeman a bunch of stuff. What happened was when you got out of the hospital, then you went to jail. But you went to the hospital first. That's just the way they operated down there. They took no prisoners. And my dad was very strict with me. He expected a lot of hard work. He expected a lot of no back talk. My sister and I were not allowed to talk about our feelings. They didn't care. Children were to be seen, not heard. And I can remember my mother, when I acted up or something, did something that a normal kid does, I can remember my mother, wait till your father gets home. And I knew that when my father got home, all hell was going to happen, man. And a lot of nights I would be laying in bed, sound asleep, and I'd get dragged out to bed and get the living crap kicked out of me. That's just flat the way it was, man. My dad was kind of an angry man, and he was disciplining me the best way that he knew how to discipline me. And I grew up afraid of my father. And I grew up afraid of being around other people. And I grew up closing in on myself. And I found something that got me outside all that kind of stuff when I was about 13 years old, and that was narcotics. I found something that got me accepted by other people when I was 13 years old, and that was narcotics. See, I didn't have to feel that fear. I didn't have to be that farm boy anymore. I could be somebody when I had the narcotics. And I can remember, and once again, I was kind of a sick child of God way before I picked up, but once I picked up, I went off to the races real quick. I remember when I went to junior high school, it was my first teen club dance, and I looked so much forward to that teen club dance, man, and everybody was going to be there. And I got me a fifth of wine, and we had a little bit of reefer, and I stashed it outside. And there was a girl that I liked, and she didn't really know that I liked her or anything. And it took me about an hour and a half to get the courage up to go up to her and ask her to dance with me. I would sit there, and I'd kind of start to walk up and say something to her, and I'd back off and stand on the corner. And finally, it was kind of getting close to the end of the night, and I had to dance with her. I walked her and said, "Would you please dance with me?" Something like that, you know. And she said, "Okay." And I got up and I started dancing with her. I had never danced in my whole life. Once again, I'm a farm boy who fed the hogs and cut the tobacco. I never danced with nobody my whole life. And as I'm dancing with her, I know she's kind of smiling and grinning. And I looked around, and everybody that was staying around was laughing at me. I mean, I was devastated by that. I was ashamed, and I felt so embarrassed by that. And one guy really was running his mouth, and he was kind of a bully and a guy that I didn't like anyway. So I left. I just walked. I was almost in tears, and I just left and walked outside in the parking lot, and I got my fifth of liquor. I was going to share it with my buddies. It went down in about three shots. I got a good one on and smoked my little bit of reefer, and I waited for that guy to come outside, and when he had his back turned, I took that bottle of liquor and I busted it right upside his head. I broke it upside him, and I want to let everybody know, man, you mess with me, you laugh at me, you fool with me, you're going to pay for it. And you know, I share that to say that that's an issue. I'm talking about self-rejection. It always, I needed the validation of other people, and it always hurt so much when other people had something bad to say. I'm talking about in recovery. It always hurt so badly to me when someone had someone negative to say about me. You see, they were validating how I really felt about myself. How I really felt about myself. If they didn't like me and they didn't think, it must be true. The story that I told myself my whole life, it must be true. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy. I'm really a piece of crap. Like my daddy used to say, you're never going to amount to nothing. It's all true. You know? And really, like Pauline said, the process of, I like to stand up here and tell y'all that the process of self-acceptance, that I have the formula for it, that I have all the answers. I believe everybody's process in the rooms is their own process. For me, it's the process of the 12 steps. Practicing the principles of this program and learning about them. And I'll tell you what, I didn't learn about no steps by listening to other people talking about them. I learned about them by going to step meetings and trying to apply them in my own life and getting into the literature, you know, of this program. The first thing that I had to accept was the fact that I was an addict, that I had a disease that wanted my life. And I had to understand the fact that just because I stopped using, that I was still an addict. You ever go to meetings to hear people talk about how what they did in their active addiction? This is what I did in my active addiction. I don't know about nobody else in this room. My disease is alive and well right now. It's active. I don't know if any of y'all ever been in denial and recovery. I don't know if y'all ever rationalized and justified the most outrageous sort of nonsense in recovery. Maybe I'm the only one. Yeah. I don't know if anybody else has ever been self-centered in recovery. You know, I had to accept the fact that this disease still wants my life and it still is with me no matter what I do. And every meeting I go to, it hears everything that's going on in these rooms. And it's just waiting. And I believe that what this program does is it kind of locks the disease up and arrests it, but it's still waiting to break out anytime. And I have to be vigilant about this. So the first thing I had to do was the fact that I needed help. And once again, I got to go back to the point that you people accepted me and you people loved me when I couldn't stand myself. I mean, people in this room, there's a lot of people in this room that remember me when I first got clean. I had hair down to here. I would go into meetings and talk about the most outrageous bunch of stuff, and y'all people would not throw me out. Y'all would say, keep coming back. You know, the thing that really got to me when I first went to all these step meetings up in town and up around the Williams Center and Prince George County, everybody was talking about God. God, 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 God. Every meeting. By the grace of God, and God is so good. God is wonderful. You know, and I wanted to stop shooting dope. I wanted to stop doing all that, but I really ain't wanting on all that God stuff that y'all were talking about. And I remember I had about 4 or 5 months clean one night at a meeting at the Williams Center. It was one of those meetings, God, God, God. And I'm getting burning up, and I'm getting angry, and I'm getting resentments the whole time. And the speaker of the meeting, he made the mistake of calling on me. He said, sir, it looks like you might want to share. Would you like to share? Now, people know me. I've always spoke my mind. I don't care. I've always spoke my mind ever since I've been around here. I'm not trying to front no image. That's the way I am. That's my personality. Like me or not, that's, you know, what you see is what you get. I said, you know, I'm really getting pissed off about all you in this meeting talking about God. It's pissing me off. I think all y'all are full of shit. I don't think none of y'all know what the hell you're talking about. I really don't, man. I'm sick of it. And people told me to keep coming back. And that man came up to me. He had a lot of years, Randy. He came up to me after the meeting. He said, man, I really appreciate the way you shared tonight. He said, you know what, man, that kind of honesty is what's going to keep you around here. That kind of honesty and being where you at is what's going to keep you around. Thank you for sharing. You see, we got to be honest about our belief if we're going to grow spiritually around here. I had to be honest about my lack of belief. And I thought, man, I can't get thrown out of this motherfucker even when I'm trying to get thrown out of it. There must be something to this shit, man. Well, I was trying to get... My disease didn't want me sitting in a meeting. My disease didn't want me not using. My disease wanted me dead, like it still does. And I started to open my mind up a little bit. And I went through the same part of the process with all that, like a lot of people do. Fake it till you make it. And I started learning about the literature. And I started learning how to sound good in a meeting. That was part of my phase of recovery. I wanted to impress people with what I shared. And I wanted to be profound. I wanted to be the one that everybody came up to after the meeting. And said, man, you turned that meeting out. Yeah. You are the man. You are the one. And kind of some things happened in my life right about then, too. I thought, what can I do with the rest of my life? Remember, once again, I came in here low, low bottom. And I thought, I'll be a counselor. I can take my experience and all my recovery and be a counselor and work in the addictions field. Be careful what you pray for and be careful what you ask for in these rooms, because God loves me enough, he'll give it to me. What happened was, with about a year and a half clean, I'm going to work with my hair cut, with a tie on, and I'm a member of staff. Crazy and sicker than hell. And I'm a staff member. We had staff meetings. And I'm sponsoring people with a year and a half clean. I got it going on, man. Doing better. I'm driving a car. A truck, excuse me. But it was mine. Some people know my story, remember it better than I do. Part of my job was working with adolescent clients. And one night, a girl came into the treatment facility and she looked like Kelly Bundy on Married with Children. 17 years old. And she was a lot like personality-wise like Kelly Bundy on Married with Children too. The first night she was there, she came up to me and let me know what she wanted to do to me. How cute she thought I was and the things that she wanted. And once again, my disease was like, damn. I'm a sick guy, you know, but I'm the counselor. And I played with that. I played with that idea as it was coming at me. Every little letter is being wrote to me. I played with that for every day for 3 weeks. And one night, right before I took the clients out to the meeting, I went into a room to ask her to get ready to come on. And she told me what she wanted to do to me. And I was in that space, and I sat down in that bed, and I let her start doing it to me for 30 seconds. She actually physically started sexually doing something to me. I'm her counselor. I'm the one that's responsible for her. And I'm sitting there letting a 17-year-old minor do that. And I stopped it. I said, this isn't right. Stop. Stop. In that amount of time, in that little amount of seconds, in that little amount of time, all the recovery went right out the window. I'm here to tell you, within an hour later, I had alcohol in me, and I was on my way down to shoot dope. I use behind that with time clean in this program. It took me right out of here. I'm telling you, man, this disease is waiting to set your ass up, man, if we're not practicing the principles of this program. And all these people in the rooms that had known me, they watched me come. I tell you, man, a lot of wonderful things happened then, a lot of things that were, I'll tell you, people knew that I relapsed before I could go to a meeting and tell anybody about it. You know, the one thing that I did right throughout that whole time was I kept coming back to meetings. I never stopped going to meetings. And people in the rooms did some talking about me and this and that. And you know, the other thing is that once I released this addiction, I couldn't stop using just because I wanted to. I'm here to tell you that once this disease is let out, all the knowledge and all the spirituality couldn't stop me from using. And for 8 months, I came in. I know what it's like to come to a meeting now and be stoned as hell in the meeting. I know what it's like to go to a meeting and can't wait for the meeting to be over so I can go out and get high. I experienced all that. But the one thing that I did right was I kept coming back. I had lawyers, I had people in the rooms tell me over that, that when you go to court about all this, man, you know, really it's basically your word against her word, man, and they ain't never going to convict you of shit, man. But I knew in my heart what I'd done and what part I had played in it. And the last night before I went to my trial was the last night that I used. And I went to trial, and instead of trying to bullshit my way out of all that, I stood up in front of that judge and I said, I'm guilty. And I took my medicine. And you think being afraid of standing up in front of y'all today is something to be afraid of? Standing up in front of a judge facing a whole lot of years, that's something to be terrified about. That was my reality. And they gave me a break, you know. They gave me, you know, a little over a year. And that's a good thing. Today, that was a blessing, because being behind bars, it brought me closer to the God of my understanding. It brought me real, and it brought me closer to myself. I'm talking about things that I got to accept about me, not only today, who I'm, but that's part of my past, and I have to accept that. And I made the amends that I need to make about all that, because I don't do that shit no more. You know, I see a new female, something like that, I give her distance. That's how I practice this program. And I'm not ashamed of what I did. That just happened. You know, I really beat myself up for a long time about all that, for a long time. And I knew people still in the rooms were talking about me. And one night I had the opportunity to be with Miss Doreen. I don't know if anybody knows Doreen P or not, but I had the opportunity to be alone with Doreen. And I thought, what the fuck, man? I'm going to sit here and I'm just going to dump it all out, man. I'm going to tell her. And I had told so many people about what happened. But just being alone with that lady, she listened to me and she said, child, that night that that happened, it wasn't about you being a counselor and her being your client. It was about two sick addicts being in the wrong spot at the same time. And when two addicts are sick and they're wrong, anything can happen. She said, get your foot out your ass, let that crap out, and walk away from it. And when she said that, I wept. I broke down and I wept, man. And I let it go, man. I let it go right at that point in time. And I just kept walking forward. In the fourth step, and once again, I kind of have a real distorted perception of reality. A lot of people come to meetings and they talk about what they got out of their fourth step and how much they derived. I was told when I wrote my fourth step, sit down, pray to God, put the truth down as best you can on the paper, and do not try to analyze yourself, because you got a crazy person analyzing yourself. Don't try to figure it out. And that's kind of what I did. I wrote the truth down as best I could about the things that I felt, the resentments, the good parts, the bad parts, as best I could. And I stopped at that point. And this is the beauty of the fifth step of this program. I've been fortunate to take several fifth steps with people that kind of got a clue of what's going on. My experience with the fourth step is what I write on the lines is my version of the truth, but where the truth is what's really in between the lines. And that's the benefit of sharing my version of it with somebody else, is they were able to point out what was really up in between those lines. You know, so I could really see what reality really was. And today, when I operate and when I do anything, I really try my best to operate from a place of reality. Not reality of what I want it to be or what I think it should be or what it could be, what it might be, but reality flat out what it is. Sometimes reality is a motherfucker. Painful reality of life is it can be hard at times. But if I'm operating from some place that's not in reality, my life remains unmanageable, man. I'm just jackpotting myself. That's why I'm so blessed to have people in my life to keep me focused on the reality. And also, you ever hear a lot of people go to fifth step meetings and they talk about all the freedom and all the relief and how it's such great that the burden is gone? That's not my experience. I got pissed off, man, because I saw how much work there was left to do. You know, it's like, well, you just start now, brother. Now, a lot of people in recovery, you know, they say six and seven go together and all that, and whatever. That's your experience. And a lot of people say that you better have a good first three steps, because the fourth step, I tell people that I sponsor, you better have a good foundation under your belt, because the sixth step is the one that's going to really run your butt. My experience is I had the awareness and I started to accept myself a little bit of what really made me operate. And I had a clue of what was going on, why I did the things I did, why I would go to meetings and I would miss all the 100 beautiful things. And I'd focus on that one motherfucker that broke the tradition. And I'd be sure to tell everybody about it after the meeting, you know. Negativity. You know, it manifested itself in so many ways. I knew why all that stuff was happening. And I really had a desire to change and to be different. And like Pauline said, I could not change myself on my own. I could not bring myself to change. I had the willingness, but I tried to, once again, do it my way. And I would do the same things and feel the same way over and over and over and over. We call it insanity, repeating the same mistakes, expecting different results in the literature. And I reached a place in recovery where the pain of living got so bad that I knew, and it's relationships, you know, that's what I'm talking about, that kind of stuff, and going back and forth and getting my heart broke and with the same person and going right back into it. That was really a blessing, just like going to jail. That was a blessing in my life too. But I got to a place with all that stuff that one of three things was going to happen. Either I was going to use, or I was going to commit murder, or I was going to commit suicide, and I knew it. I mean, I was there, man. And that was a blessing that I reached that place, because it was at that place that I became entirely ready. I was so fucking sick. And I didn't humbly ask God to remove my shortcomings. I was begging out of desperation. Out of complete desperation. You know, you ain't hit a bottom till you hit one up in here, man. Thank God you people loved me and told me to keep coming back with all that. And it was at that point in time in my recovery that I decided something's got to change, or one of those three things are going to happen. And I made a commitment to my God, please just do whatever you want to do with me. Please take my life and do whatever it is. Make me into whatever it is. I am sick and tired of being Brian, clean. I am sick and tired of feeling the way that I feel. And I embarked on a voyage right at that point in my recovery. I decided, you know what, Brian, I'm going to stop fixing myself, looking outside of myself. I'm going to stop going to meetings trying to pick up that available newcomer. I'm going to start going to meetings, and I'm going to keep my mouth shut and listen and stop running my mouth about what other people are saying in the meetings. I'm going to go to work. I'm going to do my 8 hours, and I'm going to go home and just sit back and chill and not go outside looking. And right about that point in time, I was in a pretty decent job, and because of my health problems, the doctors told me, if you keep working in this line of work with some chemicals, it's going to kill you. You're going to die if you keep doing that. You talk about hitting a bottom. One day I'm making X amount of dollars a year. Next day I'm out of a relationship and I'm out of work. And I went to a meeting down in Tri-County area, and I shared like I always do. This is what's going on with me. I don't feel like using. I just feel like saying, fuck it, man. I'm tired of showing up. And a guy in this program came up to me after the meeting and said, Brian, you know, I work for this parts company, and if you want, I can get you a job there. Don't pay much. Actually, it paid $5.20 an hour. And if you want a job and you want something to do, I can get you on. And I didn't have nothing to lose, so I went to work, and I made up my mind, if I'm going to be an auto parts driver, I'm going to be the best auto parts driver that store ever or that company ever saw. You know, that's where I was in recovery. I was so sick and tired of life, I'm ready to start over all the way. And it was through that seventh step, and I started asking God every day, not just when I felt like it, not just when things were going good, bad, but I mean even when things were feeling better. I started asking God, please, and I got into the habit of doing that. And the seventh step is we're really in my recovery where the rubber met the road. And it's where all that God shit that I heard when I first come around, I found out y'all were telling me the truth about that. I found out that God was my partner. And I found out what you people are saying, that God can do for you what you can't do for yourself. It was the truth. I started changing. And I started feeling a little bit better about myself. And every Friday night, this was my treat. I'd go to Taco Bell and I'd get a number three. That's the hard tacos with the white sauce in it. That was my weekly treat to myself, that I spent $5 and I started saving money. That little $5. Now, actually, you can save money on that little bit sometimes if you put a little bit aside. And once again, let me jump ahead in my story now. Today, I'm the assistant manager of the same store that does $2.5 million. From the parts driver who started there. That was a result of me going to work, working the extra days, when I wanted to cuss a customer out and somebody going, I can get that starter down at Pep Boys for $50 cheaper. And I want to say, well, why don't you go down to Pep Boys and get it, you stupid mother? Why are you staying here wasting my time with that shit, man?
Hurry up down to Pep Boys.
What you people told me was, I can go, well, sir, our product is a little bit better quality, and we offer a little bit longer guarantee. And maybe you might want to try our product before you go to Pep Boys. And the guy goes, okay, and I got his money, man. See, a lot of it's doping.
Sell it.
I learned about auto parts business, man, way before I went out stealing batteries when I was 18 years old, man. $10, man. In the eighth step and the ninth step, I had to become willing to accept the fact that I caused a lot of harm in other people's lives. And I'm a believer that what I want to have is the best possible relationship that I can with all other human beings. And sometimes that means I got to love them from a distance. You know, sometimes that don't mean everybody can be in my life. Through the eighth step, I became willing to really look at my part into things and what I had done. And I'm one of them guys that I really can't experience the pain that I cause till it happens to me. And I tell you what, if you've ever been involved with somebody who goes back out and relapses and that kind of stuff and know how that makes you feel, I realize how I made people that love me feel in my life. You know, and I devastated anybody that I came into contact with when I was out there using. And so I'm one of them people, man, that really, you know, went all the way with the ninth step, man. And I didn't go into it. I was told don't go into the ninth step with a lot of expectations. And that's my experience. I went to some people. They told me, stay the hell away from me. I don't want nothing to do with you. But I knew that I had done all that I could do to make my side of the street clean. And if they didn't forgive me, so what? God forgave me. And I started to be able to forgive myself for the things. And all I can do is continuously try to live the way that I live today, live by the principles of this program. There's still more work to be done in that area. Just like Pauline said, more will be revealed. But I've got a lot more. I thought I had made all the amends I need to make. And it seems like every day, no matter what I do, there's things that I need to. But, you know, the really good news, by practicing the principles of this program, most days go by, I don't have to add nobody else to my eight-step list. You know, I'm not out there intentionally or unintentionally causing harm a whole lot anymore. They said this is a 75-minute meeting. I guess we're getting kind of close, but I want to acknowledge the presence of somebody. I'm not going to break his anonymity, but he's in the room tonight. I seen him come in today. My last sponsor, his name was Bill T, and he passed away. He was at this convention last year I shared, and he was here, and he was dying of terminal cancer, and he was such a profound instrument in my recovery. And the sponsor I had before him, he passed away too. Not as a result of using, but died clean. I got a new sponsor. I hope he wish him better luck. I kind of got a thing with sponsors here, but anyway, one of the reasons that I asked Bill, and I love Bill so much, but a lot of the reason I asked Bill to be my sponsor is because I knew who his sponsor was. I knew where it came from. And that man, I mean, he don't even know that I know him maybe that much, but he was like one of the most instrumental people, said the most, that just hit home early in recovery. He's the first person I said you could hear say you could have a castle in here, you could have a hut. And a lot of my personality, a lot of the way I am, I've tried to mold it. I want to be like him. You know, they say don't put nobody on a pedestal, and I'm not trying to, but there are role models and there are examples in this program, and I believe that. What I'm trying to say with self-acceptance, something I heard him say a long time ago, so this is all not Brian, this is all something I've heard, but this is how I try to carry this. It really don't make no damn difference what nobody in this room thinks about me, for real. I am not in here to win some NA popularity contest in here. No matter what I do, I'm not going to please everybody anyway. If I'm pleasing everybody, running around doing this and that, I'm fucking myself. I'm going to get screwed up. I need to be right with Brian, and I need to be right with the God of my understanding. And if you like me, that's fine. That's all benefit, and that's all gravy on the biscuit. And if you don't like me, and you don't like that, that's your shit. And that's how I carry my life. I went around so long trying to make you like me, trying to say and do what I thought, because that's what I was brought up with my mom and my dad. I wanted to make them proud of me. That's just a waste of idle, it's idle chit-chat in my head. Today, what I try to do is serve and be the kind of person that my God wants me to be. Really, that's where the steps, and that's how I accept myself today, as a humble servant of God. I'm one of them people that believe that not only can I practice these principles in the rooms and sound good in the rooms, this is about taking this outside anywhere I go. Just like when I was using, I could harm anybody I came into contact with. I can apply these principles and affect anybody I come into contact out there in a positive way. I don't do it all the time. I fall way, way short. Don't get me wrong. But that's what I try to do. Try to treat people with kindness and with love and with tolerance. And life is really good today, man. It's like Bill used to say, the more that you try to give around here, I don't know how this works. The more that you try to give, the more that you get. And I'm going to close out with my story and I like to tell. And I hope everybody has a good time at the convention. But I hope this happens for everybody who's new in the rooms, or if it hadn't happened to any of your old timer. The first mini convention of the South Potomac area was held when I first came in. That I had 4 months clean. I went to a meeting that was about this big, even bigger. And at the end of the speakers' meeting, they did what was called a clean time countdown. They're going to have one tonight if you've never seen one. They started out with 20 years or more and went down by, and everybody stood up for how much time they had, and everybody clapped. And they got down to 1 year, and then they got down to months, 11 and 10. And they got down to 4 months, and I had 4 months clean, and I stood up, and everybody clapped, and that felt good. And... And then they got down to 1 month, and then they got down to weeks, 3 weeks, and 2 weeks, and 1 week, and then they got down to days, 6 days. It seemed like the more down they went, the more people were standing up. And back then, I think the most time in the room was like 10 or 11 years. But they got down to days. They got down to 6 and 5, and they got down to the most important person in the room. Anybody with 24 hours, any parts of 24 hours, or just a desire for a new way of life. And out of all those people, and like I say, that was the biggest meeting. There was about 300-400 people in that room. This one girl stood up, and she looked just like a lot of us look when we get here. Her hair was all messed up, and her dress was all in tatters, and she didn't look good. And she tried to hobble toward the front of the room, and what happened next, the only way I keep saying it like this because it's the only way I know to describe it, it's like someone took a match and threw it on the gasoline. The whole place just, whoom! Erupted. Everybody jumped up out of the chair and were cheering and running up to embrace her and screaming, keep coming back, keep coming back. And I mean, you could feel the walls shaking, man. All the energy just went off right then. And if anybody had been looking at me with my 4 months clean, toxic as hell, I was sitting in the middle of all that with my face buried up in my hands because I was ashamed. I didn't want nobody to see me crying. I was crying like a baby, man. I didn't know why the fuck I was crying. I couldn't tell you what I was feeling. But I was crying tears, and I didn't want nobody to see me. And really, what happened at that moment, for the first time, I felt the power of this program, and I felt the love of this fellowship, and I felt the grace of God enter my heart, and I accepted it. And no matter what's happened in my life since then, and believe me, that's been years ago, there's been a whole lot that's happened, a whole lot that's happened. My life ain't never been exactly the same. That's a result of this program. And I want everybody in here to be real clear about what I believe, that against the God of my understanding and against the power of this program and the love of you people, this disease don't have no shot. As long as we try to practice these principles in all our affairs a day at a time. This is a wee program. I forget the thing we say at the end of me. Y'all help me out with it. How's that thing go? So long as I follow that way. And that's the message of recovery. Y'all, thanks a lot, and I hope y'all have a good time.